Crime Happens contains coarse language, adult themes, and content of a violent and disturbing nature. It is not intended for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised. Hi everyone, welcome to Crime Happens, where we uncover the evil that surrounds us. I'm your host, Chris. Who hasn't walked by an abandoned house? Maybe you slow down a little to see if you can see anything, or maybe you pick up your pace a little because it feels kind of creepy and you just want to put some distance between you and that house. Whatever the case, abandoned houses seem to pique our curiosity and maybe even frighten us a tiny bit. Years and years ago, I had an up-close and personal encounter with an abandoned house, which is why this particular episode caught my attention. I had just started a new job in a new city and needed a place to live. I ended up renting a small house in what I thought looked like a nice enough neighborhood. It was situated in a quiet cul-de-sac, and most of the houses looked just like mine. From what I could see, people kept their lawns mowed, kids were riding their bikes up and down the street, and played in their yards. Everything looked normal, except for one house, my new next-door neighbor. I immediately noticed that the house was dark at night. The only light inside was not coming from flipping a switch and turning the lights on. All of the windows were covered with sheets, blankets, or newspapers. The grass was completely overgrown, making it stand out from the rest of the homes in the neighborhood. Every night, the driveway and the street out front was filled with cars as if there was a big party going on. Cars were coming and going. People were coming and going. The music was loud and the shouting and laughter was nonstop. This would go on until the wee hours of the morning. Our houses were so close together, I almost felt as if I could knock on their window by leaning out of mine. I used to peek through my blinds trying to catch a glimpse of something, anything, but it was just too dark to see, and the windows were all covered. I didn't know what the hell was happening next door, but I knew something wasn't right, and I was getting pissed off. I couldn't believe my luck. I had the neighbors from hell, and there didn't seem to be an end in sight. How effing long was I going to have to live like this? But then one day, I came home from work, and I saw a white piece of paper stuck to the front door of this house. It was secured with red tape. You don't see red tape like that very often, and my eyes were immediately drawn to it. I tentatively walked up to the door to see what was going on. I was a little nervous, but my curiosity got the better of me. On the door, along with a very big chain, was a very big padlock. I read the document, which was something like an eviction notice which had been posted by the police. Very soon after this happened, I saw a short notice in the newspaper reporting that the house had been used for drugs and prostitution. In that moment, everything finally made sense. These weren't neighbors who just couldn't afford curtains or blinds. This house had been taken over by squatters, and these people turned the house into a hub for criminal activity. Discovering the truth about what was really going on next door was definitely unsettling. It was a chilling reminder that bad things can happen, even in seemingly good neighborhoods. There's something about abandoned houses that instantly create a feeling of foreboding. Even if you're just passing by, you can feel those creepy vibes. The windows might be boarded up or just broken out. You can imagine all kinds of horrible things hiding in there. Rats, spiders, rotten old furniture, filthy clothes left behind, drug paraphernalia, broken liquor bottles, and of course, urine and feces left by animals and people. And maybe even a violent predator lurking inside. The house on Madrona Street in northwest Atlanta, Georgia, was just such a house. It was abandoned, but not vacant. It had no electricity and no running water, but according to the neighbors, the house appeared to be occupied by squatters. They say there were never any lights on, but people were constantly coming and going. Sound familiar? And this particular house was known to the community as a drug house. I never saw the inside of the house next door to me, but I have a feeling it might look a little bit like the inside of the house on Madrona Street. Like any big city, there are going to be pockets that are more problematic than others. Atlanta is not just the capital of Georgia, but it's also one of its biggest cities. And in northwest Atlanta, there are some neighborhoods that can be a little dicey. Depending on which block you're on, it's not uncommon to see houses that are abandoned, vacant, or just poorly maintained. They tend to have a higher crime rate, with property crimes leading the pack. Car break-ins and burglaries are the most common crimes, with occasional outbreaks of violence. The violence is usually tied to a specific situation and not necessarily random acts, but it's still scary. It's an area where one street can feel fine while another one nearby feels decidedly unsafe. If you live in this area, you may not want to be out walking alone at night, and you don't want to leave anything visible in your parked car unless you want it stolen. 1710 Madrona Street was a little blue house with an awning over its front door and windows. It sat well back from the street, and if it weren't so run down and neglected, it could have been cute. Instead, it was an eyesore. It was dirty and dilapidated. There's a big 50-gallon metal barrel sitting out in the front yard by the front porch at a serious lean, completely rusted over. The once white shutters on the windows are black with filth, and dirty white plastic yard furniture is tipped over in the burned out grass, and every part of the house is deteriorating and falling apart. At 1 p.m. on Friday, December 19, 2014, a woman called 911 stating that she had found a dead body in one of the back rooms of the house on Madrona Street. When the 911 operator asked how she knew the person was dead, she said the body was covered with a sheet. Police were dispatched to the location immediately. As detectives entered the house, they moved slowly and cautiously from room to room. Because there's no lighting, they're using a big portable floodlight with handles to see inside the house. The stench that greeted them was overwhelming. The inside of the house was a garbage-riddled mess. There were large stains on the walls where it looked like something had leaked from above and was dripping downwards. There was a cracked and broken lamp which was knocked over, a dresser tipped over with its drawers all pulled out, lying in broken pieces on the floor, and upholstered chairs which were stained and disgusting. You would not want to sit on those. You can see an old plate filled with cigarette butts that have been stubbed out. Beside the plate is a crack pipe and a green and white pack of Newport cigarettes. Every inch of flooring in every room was covered in garbage. It's a disgusting dumping ground for every kind of trash you can think of. Several old mattresses were lying on the floors or leaning up against a wall, gross blankets, and tarps and paint cans. It's going to take a lot more than paint to make a dent in this catastrophe. The countertops and every surface in that house are layered thick with rat droppings. And in the bathroom, which is barely accessible due to all the garbage shoved in there, is a really big plastic bucket filled with human feces. Even seasoned homicide detectives describe it as something you would see in a horror film. Finally, in a back room, detectives find the dead body, which has been covered by a sheet. The gagging stench of garbage and feces is only made worse by the smell of decomp. When they pull the sheet back, they can see that it's a young woman. Her mouth is wrapped in duct tape and her legs are spread open. It's clear that she's been badly beaten, sexually assaulted, and strangled. It's a horrific sight, and there is no doubt that this woman suffered a horrible, painful death. Her clothes, including her bra and panties, were cut off and lay in a pile next to her body. They also see a fingernail, which is broken off and it's lying next to her, indicating a possible struggle. There is a roll of duct tape nearby and black shoelaces next to her body. Based on the ligature marks on her neck, detectives wonder if these were used to strangle her. On the closet door in the same room where the body is found, someone has scrawled the words, "Look, bitch, I'm done," in big red letters. At this point, detectives can't tell if this has any connection to the dead body they've just discovered. Because her eyes have started to cloud over, the medical examiner's preliminary findings are that she's most likely been dead from 1 to 2 days. By this time, the house and its property are surrounded with crime scene tape. Uniformed officers are keeping people from crossing the line, and a medical examiner's van is parked out front. Local news stations are on site, and their vans are parked up and down the street. Cameras are set up along the sidewalk where news stations are reporting the events live as they unfold. Whenever there's a police presence like this in a neighborhood, crowds will begin to form, especially when it's clear that a dead body is involved. Some are just looky-loos. Many are people who live close by and they're curious about what's happening in their neighborhood, and some are worried about their friends or family. Detectives have been working the scene for about 2 hours, gathering evidence when a neighbor approached. He was an older gentleman, and he tells detectives that he's worried the body they just found may be a friend of his who's missing. He shows them a photo of his friend that he has on his cell phone. He explains that he got 2 phone calls from her on Tuesday, but he didn't answer because he and his girlfriend were watching TV at the time. He just figured he would call her back later. The neighbor states that his missing friend has no enemies, that she's a good person, and she has 2 little girls. He tells detectives that his missing friend is a young woman named Heather Camp. He also explains that he's a good friend of Heather's and even talks to Heather's dad every now and then. Based on the photo, it looks to detectives like this guy may be right. The dead woman found strangled in the back room of this house just might be his friend. Next, detectives talk to the woman who made the 911 call. As it turns out, she's the owner of the house. She says she has no idea who could have done this. According to her, all the locks on the house are broken, making any keys pointless. She told detectives that a lot of the windows were broken out, leaving the house open to anyone. What she fails to mention at this time is that her son is living there. The lead detective, Scott DeMeester, invites her to the station so he can conduct a more formal interview. The rest of the team stay behind and continue to process the scene for evidence under the supervision of Detective Velasquez. Down at the station, the woman tells DeMeester that she has not physically been inside the house for about 3 weeks. She explains that even though the house is supposed to be vacant, she lets her son, Ardentric Dion Johnson, stay there. Johnson is a 36-year-old drug addict with a long history of criminal activity and convictions for carrying a concealed weapon, theft, false imprisonment, and battery. Johnson is a career criminal and has been released from rehab where he was being treated for his crack addiction. Again, he's done multiple stints in rehab. Rehab did absolutely nothing for him, and he was back to his old ways from the minute he got dropped off by his mother at the Madrona Street house. Johnson's mother tells DeMeester that when he got out of rehab about a week and a half ago, she picked him up and brought him to the Madrona Street house. She drove him over there on the Saturday before the dead body was found and dropped him off along with his roller bag suitcase. There's a side room near the bedroom, which is disgusting, but not quite as trashed as the rest of the house, and she says he slept in that room. She also tells detectives that Johnson's drug of choice is crack and he smokes Newport cigarettes. She states that the next time she saw Johnson was on Thursday, just one day prior to the body being found. She tells DeMeester that she came by, picked him up and took him to McDonald's and bought him something to eat. Then she went back to the house again on Friday, but this time she went inside. And it was during this visit that she found the body and called 911. DeMeester asked her why she went back to the house on Friday and why she decided to go inside. She tells him that she went for no particular reason. She just thought she would go over. But when he presses her, she admits that Johnson told her he had done something, but he didn't say what. She claims she had no idea what he was talking about. Obviously, she thought he had done something pretty bad, got worried, and decided she needed to go check it out. She didn't offer any more information, but she did try to call him from the station, and Johnson didn't answer. According to his mother, she has no idea where he could be at and may go days and days without talking to him. At this point, the interview is over and she leaves the station. Detective Benton, another detective on the team, who was in the office at the time of the interview, overhears the name Ardentric Johnson as a possible suspect, and she tells DeMeester that she's familiar with this guy. Benton also tells him that his nickname is Murder Man. Based on what they know so far, detectives can't help but wonder if the person who did this was just high or if he's a cold-blooded killer. Back at the crime scene, detectives are busy gathering evidence. Along with other evidence, they take fingernails, every cigarette butt they can find, the roll of duct tape, and a rape kit. Detectives also find a backpack in the side bedroom. When they open the backpack, they find papers containing the name Ardentric Johnson. Then, DeMeester calls his team, who are still back at the house, and shares with them the information he got from Johnson's mother and Benton. He provides them with the name of their possible suspect, Ardentric Dion Johnson. As it turns out, the team just came up with the same name when they found that backpack containing those papers with his name on them. DeMeester also shares with the team the suspected killer's nickname, Murder Man. As detectives canvass the neighborhood, they manage to track down people known to frequent the house. These folks tell detectives that the house is obviously used for illegal purposes. They also share with detectives the name Ardentric Johnson as an individual known to stay at the house. And as it turns out, police are no stranger to this house. They had been called out quite a few times in 2014 alone. At this point, detectives now have their primary suspect, and his name is Ardentric Dion Johnson, aka Murder Man. Detectives had been at the house since 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and it was past midnight when they began to wrap things up. With no electricity, it was even more difficult to see inside the house than it was during daylight hours. Detectives have finally secured a search warrant for the house and begin their final walkthrough. Using the handheld floodlight, they open doors, drawers, and look in crawl spaces for anything else they may have missed. While doing this, they find a closet door that won't open. Upon closer inspection, they can see the door has been nailed shut. They manage to pry the door open and are shocked when they find a second body. It's buried under a huge pile of filthy clothes, blankets, and garbage, but they can see 2 feet sticking out from under this mess, and the feet are tied together. The second body is found in the same room as the first body, but in the closet. The same closet with the words, "Look, bitch, I'm done," scrawled on it. The medical examiner had to be called back to the scene. When he examined the second body, he could determine that it was female, but it was so badly decomposed that not much else could be determined. Fingerprints were not possible. What they could see is that the person had a ligature of rope with at least 3 strands around her neck, along with strangulation marks. There was no ID anywhere to be found, so identifying this woman was going to take some extra work. Although there were some similarities in the 2 victims' injuries, their causes of death would need to wait for the autopsies. Channel 2 Action News asked detectives how it was possible for the body to go unnoticed for such a long time. They explained that even though the body was badly decomposed, the house was in terrible shape. There's no electricity or indoor plumbing, and squatters have done some serious damage. The garbage, animal activity, and human feces could help mask the smell of decomposition. WSB-TV reported that in 2014, police had been called to the Madrona house 14 times for prostitution, drugs, and fighting. Based on information gathered from the people familiar with the house, detectives also learned that Heather was last seen with Johnson at the Madrona Street house. At the time, detectives stated that even though the investigation was in the beginning stages, they believed that both murders took place inside the house and are definitely connected. They will know more when they are able to identify the second victim found in the closet. Once they confirmed there were no more bodies, they called it a wrap. A patrol car stayed behind to guard the house overnight. Their plan was to come back the next day with cadaver dogs when it was light out. The next morning, cadaver dogs were brought to the house, and fortunately, no other bodies were found. Detectives also continued talking to the neighbors as they began their search for Johnson. They ended up speaking to a man who claims to have a cell phone, which he's holding for Johnson. He tells detectives that Johnson saw him walking down the street and flagged him down. According to this witness, Johnson asked him to hold the phone for him. He said he would give him $10 to hold the phone and $20 when he picked it back up. Johnson told the guy that it was Heather's phone. This guy just happened to know Heather too, so he agreed to hold the phone. Detectives asked the witness to come down to the station and give a formal statement. While at the station, he tells detectives that Johnson was always trying to be Heather's pimp, or anybody's pimp for that matter. When detectives tell him there was a second body found and ask if he knows of any other missing women, he says yes. He tells them about a woman who went missing a few months ago. They even put up missing person posters for her. He tells detectives that this woman knew Johnson and they used to fight all the time. Then they give this guy a photo lineup and he identified Johnson right away, calling him Murder Man, which is what most people on the street know him as. After a little digging, detectives find out this second woman had a fight with Johnson the day before she disappeared. Apparently, she filed a police report claiming that he had assaulted her. The day after her body is found, on Saturday evening, December 20th, the medical examiner's office officially identified the first body found as a young woman named Heather Camp, aged 33. She was born and raised in Canton, Georgia, and she had 2 daughters, aged 16 and 4. Detectives come across another person who happened to be out walking her dog on Madrona Street. She usually doesn't take this route, but for some reason she did on this particular day. This was about 1 week prior to the bodies being found. She stated that Johnson approached her and began to strike up a conversation. She tells detectives about this very bizarre exchange she had with him. He started off by asking her about her age and her dog. He even complimented her hair. She described it as a very awkward conversation, one that made her feel very uncomfortable. Next, he introduced himself to her as Dion. While they were talking, he pulled up his shirt and showed her that he had a gun tucked into the waistband of his pants. He then told her she would have to go with him. She calmly said, "No, I'm not going with you. I'm going to continue walking my dog." She told him that if he wanted to shoot her, he would have to do it right there, out in the open, and kept on walking. After she had created some distance between them, he ran and caught up to her. Johnson gave her a hug and said he was sorry. She told detectives that the encounter left her shaking. They told her she was very brave and reminded her of how lucky she was. While they are interviewing the dog walker, detectives get a call from Johnson's mother, and she tells them that he's at an address just outside of Atlanta. Detectives immediately head over to that location, and thankfully Johnson is apprehended and arrested without incident. He was brought to the station for processing and questioning. At the time, he was only being detained on a probation hold for violating his probation with possession of cocaine, family violence, and false imprisonment. They weren't sure how long they would be able to hold him, so they really needed to move fast. Ardentric Johnson was a 36-year-old drug addict living in the abandoned house on Madrona Street, which was owned by his mother. He's been in and out of rehab for his drug addiction to crack and was just recently released again. Immediately after his latest release, he was right back to his old ways of smoking crack, drinking, and committing acts of violence. Records show that Johnson has been in and out of Fulton County Jail since 1996. His charges included battery, forgery, false imprisonment, and drug charges. His life was a revolving door of drugs, violence, and jail. Johnson's name first came to the attention of detectives in regard to these murders during the initial questioning of his mother after she called 911 to report a dead body found in her house. His name continued to surface when detectives spoke to people in the area known to frequent the house and when friends of the victims came forward to share what they knew. Detective Velasquez had Johnson brought to an interview room and began to question him. Velasquez started out by asking him if he was familiar with the Madrona Street house. Johnson replied that, yes, he's familiar with the house, but he denies being anywhere near the house and claims he was never in the house. When he's challenged, he eventually admits to being in the house a week ago and admits to Velasquez that he has personal belongings and clothes at the house. He tells Velasquez that he knows Heather, but he hasn't seen her in a couple of weeks. He said the last time he saw her, she was just walking down the street by herself. He says he knows her through an old girlfriend who he had dated for years. When they find out about his old girlfriend, they immediately begin to track down any information they can find on her. Their main concern is that she might be dead too. As Velasquez continued to ask about Heather, Johnson denied ever having been in the house with her and claims they never had a relationship and they never had sex. When they ask if he knows what happened to her, Johnson says no. When they tell him that she was murdered, he acted very surprised, saying that this was news to him. When they tell him that she was killed in his house, the house he was staying in, he responds with, "What the fuck? Shit, that'd be crazy." They asked him how he thought that might have happened, and he said he had no idea. He doesn't participate in stuff like that. They asked him about the cell phone he gave to a friend to hold, but of course he denied any knowledge of that. Finally, he breaks down and admits that he gave the phone to someone to hold for $10. He says he gave the phone to this other person weeks ago, but detectives knew that wasn't true. They believe it actually happened the day Heather died. In the search for Johnson's old girlfriend, they find out that she had reported him to the police and filed charges against him. Apparently, she wound up in the hospital after he attacked her. According to the police report, Johnson came up to her and struck her hard enough to put her in the hospital and said to her, "That's what you get." This was after he had locked her in a room for more than 46 hours, forcing her to smoke crack and take pills. She claims that he also pimped her out and made her work. He was eventually arrested for this assault and pled guilty, but was only sentenced to 4 years probation. Wow, why on earth would his sentence be so light? Although they didn't have the second body identified at the time of the interview, they were pretty confident they knew who it might be. They tell Johnson that a third woman filed a report on him 2 days before she went missing, and she was just found dead in his closet. Of course, he denies knowing anything about that. Just interesting that three women have filed charges against Johnson, and within days of filing those charges, one of them is violently attacked and two of them turn up dead. He claims his DNA won't be found anywhere in connection with either person found dead in the house, but he refuses to give a sample of his DNA. Next, he stated that he wanted his lawyer, so the interview came to an end. Fortunately, detectives had a warrant for Johnson's DNA and were able to obtain a sample before he headed off to jail for his probation violation. At this point, he hasn't confessed, but he does admit to being in possession of a dead girl's phone, a dead girl that was found in the house where he lives. When he's left alone in the interview room, he can be heard mumbling to himself, "My DNA, my DNA, my DNA. I shouldn't have fucked that bitch." Fortunately, before he can be released from jail, Johnson is finally arrested for murder. Not long after the arrest, the identity of the woman in the closet is identified as the woman who filed a complaint against him 2 days before she went missing. She is finally identified as Nicole Sartell, age 31. Friends reported Nicole missing on August 18th of 2014, which was 4 months before her body was found. Detectives believe she has probably been dead since then. A neighbor of Nicole Sartell, an older grandfatherly gentleman named Charlie Freeman, told WSB-TV that when Nicole went missing, quote, "I put out posters on her with a reward with anybody that knows her whereabouts, and we never had heard anything. I wish I knew for sure if it was her because it would ease my heart." He also said at this time, "She was like my daughter and I loved her very much," unquote. Once Nicole was officially identified, Velasquez paid a visit to her good friend Charles Freeman and broke the terrible news to him. He was extremely upset, as you can imagine. He really cared for her and had always given her a safe place to stay whenever she needed it. Detectives stated they had no reason to think anyone else was involved. They discovered that both of these women were last seen alive with Johnson, who stayed in the house on Madrona Street. They were both known to hang around with Johnson. They were both known to fight with Johnson. They were both seen at the house in Johnson's company. And they both filed charges against Johnson right before they disappeared. They were both ultimately found strangled to death and their dead bodies found in the abandoned house on Madrona Street. Why he killed them is still a mystery, and we may never know. Maybe he was angry at them for filing charges. Maybe he thought if they were dead, the charges would be dropped. We don't know for sure, but the most likely scenario for them being with Johnson at the house was for the purpose of drug use and prostitution. Whatever the reason was for them being there, it can in no way justify their murders by Ardentric Deon Johnson, aka Murder Man. Johnson's DNA was eventually confirmed to match the DNA found on the body of Heather Camp, but was inconclusive for Nicole Sartell. The bodies of these two women, Nicole Sartell and Heather Camp, found naked, beaten, and strangled in Fulton County, Georgia, is a case that's haunted police for nearly 3 years. Almost 3 years after their bodies were discovered in an abandoned house on Madrona Street, a house used for drugs and prostitution, a jury found Ardentric Deon Johnson guilty in the murders of both Nicole Sartell and Heather Camp. In addition to murder, the Fulton County District Attorney's Office stated that Ardentric Deon Johnson an 8-time felon, was convicted of rape, aggravated sodomy, aggravated assault, false imprisonment, and concealing a dead body. Under Georgia law, as a recidivist, Johnson was sentenced to life without the possibility of parole. Thank goodness this violent predator is finally off the streets for good. It's just so hard to understand why an 8-time convicted felon was still out on the street and why he was receiving such light sentences for his violent crimes. What do you think? Thanks again for tuning in to Crime Happens. All episodes are researched, written, recorded, and audio mixed by me. Crime Happens is available on Apple, Spotify, Audible, Amazon Music, and wherever you get your podcasts. Please follow or subscribe wherever you listen to get notified of new episodes. Check out my website at crimehappens.com. And be sure to follow me on Instagram at crime_happens. I'll be back very soon with an all-new episode. Until then, I wish you well.